And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Ellen Fitzgibb. Today I'll be reading from the book Belarusian Folk Tales, translated by L. Cortez. A Crippled Hero. Once upon a time, in a faraway kingdom, there lived a blacksmith with his wife. To her great sorrow, the wife gave birth to a lovely boy who was, unfortunately, a cripple. The boy grew, but it gave him little happiness. For what happiness could a born cripple bring his parents? He was treated more as a foundling than as a son. The blacksmith's wife would get to her work at the stove and would run to the field or to the vegetable patch. But the little fellow would just lie about on the ground, suck a crust of bread or munch a stewed potato. The unfortunate woman once left him lying in the yard, and the pigs nearly ate him. She didn't even pretend to care for her child. "Oh, what can we expect from him?" she said. "A cripple's no help in the house, only a burden. It'd be better for all of us if God rested his soul." However, the boy seemed to thrive on the food they gave him and the absolute lack of care. He grew well, even he couldn't walk, but just crawled about. As the woman said, whether they fed him or not, they'd get nothing out of him. At last he began cursing him and calling to God to explain to her why he'd given her a son, not for joy as to other people, but for continuous sorrow. The blacksmith listened to the curses of the foolish woman, but what could he do if she refused to feed him? The blacksmith was sorry for the boy, but his wife was poisoning his life with her curses. At last he could stand it no longer, so he harnessed the mare, put his son on the cart, and drove off with him to the forest. He drove way into the depths of the forest and wanted to leave him there, but all of a sudden he saw a small hut. He went in, but there was no one there. He looked about him, saw that there was food and drink in the hut, but no master. So he carried his son in and left him there. Then he got onto the cart, laughed at the mare, and started off without ever turning back, fearing that someone might catch up with him. The boy was left all by himself in the hut, looking around, getting acquainted with his new surroundings. A while later, an old man came in and asked for some water. "Well, I'd be glad to give you some, but I can't walk," says the boy. "Oh, here," says the old man. "Try some first. It's good water." The boy was very thirsty, and he drank all the water in the ladle. As soon as he had drunk it, he felt an extraordinary wave of strength flowing into him. It seemed he could turn the whole world upside down, if he could only manage to stand up. The old man also drank his fill and said, "Drink as much as you can of this water, for you'll need a lot of strength." He seemed to disappear into thin air, as if he'd never existed. The boy wondered whether he hadn't been dreaming, but all of a sudden, he saw that he had strong, healthy legs, that he could walk on them, and he felt that he was walking on air. He drank some more water, and it seemed to him that there was no one in the whole world as powerful as he was. He wanted to have another drink, took hold of the pail, but it slipped out of his hand, and the water slipped all over the hut. He snatched up the pail and ran to the stream, but couldn't find it anywhere. It seemed to have gone underground. He went back to the hut, but that had also disappeared. He started walking here, there, and everywhere, and finally got so mixed up, he simply didn't know where to go. So he stood quietly for a while, and then went along through the forest. On his way, he saw a huge pine tree, a little further, an oak the size of a stove. He grabbed them with one hand, and they cracked like dried straw. So he went along, throwing trees down on his way, and through the forest. He did that to mark his way so as not to come back to the same path. He walked up for quite a long while until he came out onto a road, on the sides of which lay huge stones that looked more like rocks than stones. He began to throw them onto the road, picking them up as if they were potatoes. Suddenly he saw some fine, husky young men riding along the road. They came up to him and stood confused, for the road was blocked. The great stones were now right in the middle of it. "Good day, youngster," they said. "What are you doing?" "Just playing around," answered the boy. The men got off their horses and tried to clear the way. They got hold of one stone and couldn't so much as move it. The boy came up to them, picked up the stone, and threw it into the ditch on the side of the road. "Come with us," said the young man. "How can I go with you when I have no horse? Oh, choose one of ours." The boy wanted to choose himself a horse, but couldn't find any to suit him. He barely put his hand on the beast's back. It fell to its knees immediately. He tried all the horses, and not one of them was strong enough for him. However, he went along with them, walking beside their horses. All of a sudden, he saw a music plowing the field not far from the road. His mare was small and thin, but with good sinews. The boy went up to the music, put his hand on the mare. It stood up to it without apparent effort, so he began bargaining with the music for the mare, but the owner of the beast just wouldn't consider parting with it for any money. "I don't need money," he said. "Anybody might even steal it. But how am I to get my work done without a horse? You know, a man without a horse is worthless." "Well, stop the mare for one of our horses," said the boy's new friend. "You can take the one you fancy." "No good changing one's working tools, you know," said the music. Finally, they convinced him, however, and he left his mare to the boy and took a pair of the best horses for it. The boy got on his mare, and off they went all together. On the way, they came to the village where the boy's father lived and went to him to have their horses restored. Blacksmith didn't recognize his son, he had changed clothes, and he also shoed the boy's mare. After he'd finished shoeing the horses, the boy asked the blacksmith to forge him a club. The blacksmith collected all the iron he had and forged a club that three people couldn't lift. The boy picked it up with one hand and sent it flying into the sky. And looked on in amazement. When the club came down a bit later with a thundering noise, the boy put his knee out to stop its fall, and the club hit his knee and bent crooked. The blacksmith added another foot or so of iron, forged the club anew, and they all went off together into the wide world. They came to some kingdom or other and went to work for the Tsar that ruled it. At that same time, an enormous serpent appeared in the kingdom. It came flying into the town, grabbed people, and took them to its cave. It got away with quite a lot of people and ate them all up. Finally, it decided it wanted to try royal flesh for change and carried off the Tsar's daughter. However, it didn't eat her up at once, but left her for dessert. The Tsar called to all his subjects to free his daughter and kill the serpent. He said he'd give half of his kingdom and his daughter in marriage. Many a valiant warrior tried his luck and fell victim to the fiend. At last, the strong young fellow who came to the blacksmith's son said they'd also go. "Come with us," he said to the boy. "You're very young. It's surely time for you to look for glory. We'll be your teachers and show you how to fight." The boy agreed, and off they went. After riding some time, they came to a milestone with a sign on which something was written. One of the lot could read a bit, and this is what he read to them. "He who takes the road to the right will procure glory for himself. He who takes the road to the left will procure riches. He who advances straight ahead will face death." They all chose the road to the right and went off in search of glory, excepting the boy, He said that one couldn't just get away from death in the long run anyhow, so it was better to just go ahead. His friends tried to convince him to go with them, but he was very stubborn and went straight forward, as he said. After riding a while, he came upon the very hut in which his father had left him some time ago when he was a cripple. He tied his mare to a tree and went into the hut. Glancing into the corner, he saw a very old woman sitting there. "Good day, Granny." "Oh, good day to you, young one. Where are you heading for?" "Oh, I'm just riding straight ahead of me, Granny." "Oh, don't do that, young one, for you'll die. The serpent lives there, and it eats you." "Oh, nothing doing, Granny. I'm going even if I have to perish." "Sorry for you, young one. You've been in my hut. You're sort of a grandson to me. So listen carefully and pay heed to what I tell you. Whatever you meet on your way, don't kill a single living thing that may be useful to you if you're in trouble." The boy thanked the old woman and rode off. He barely got a little way from the hut when a hare jumped out of the bushes. He grabbed his club at the hare, begged, "Oh, don't kill me. I'll be at risk to you if you're in trouble." So he went on, the hare running after him. A little further, a gray wolf came out from behind the tree. He seized his club again, but the wolf said, "Oh, don't kill me. You'll need me in trouble." He lowered the club and rode on, the wolf following in his mare's footmarks. Finally, he came to a stone mountain and saw that there was no way to go any further. He got off his mare, let her go to have her feed, and went to look for some path or road to continue his journey. The serpent crawled out of his cave to hunt for food and crawled to where the mare was feeding grass. The wolf saw that the serpent would eat the mare, so it rushed at it and frightened it so badly that it galloped off quick as lightning and got away from the serpent. The fiend found something else to feed on and returned to its cave. When the hare came running up to the boy and showed him the crack in the rock where the serpent had hidden the fire's daughter, the boy banged his club against the stone wall, and the girl appeared, saying, "Flee from here, for the serpent will eat you." The boy swung his club and smashed it against the stone wall. The girl rushed out and threw her arms around his neck, begging him to take her home to her parents. But at that moment, the serpent appeared in the crack and was just on the point of gobbling the boy up when the latter smashed his club on its head. He cut out the serpent's tongue and put it in his bag. But the heads continued to appear one after the other. The boy smashed the remaining 11 ones, and that was the end of the serpent. He cut out the whole lot of 11 tongues and put them away in his bag. The God's daughter was overjoyed that such a great hero had saved her from the wicked serpent, and of course she immediately fell in love with him and promised to marry him as soon as she got back home to her father and mother. Then she took out his small handkerchief, tore it into two halves, and gave the boy one of them. He put the handkerchief near his head and lay down and went to sleep, very, very tired after his battle with the serpent. His sleep was so deep that he didn't hear his former companion dried up. They saw the dog daughter there and began questioning her as to what had happened. She told him everything and added that she was going to marry her young hero. The fellows went, felt envious of the boy, ran up to him, and killed him in his sleep. Then they began to quarrel fiercely about who married his father's daughter. They quarreled and quarreled, and finally began to fight and fought until they killed each other, all except the strongest of them all. He made the young girl swear that she'd tell her father and mother that he was the one that killed the serpent and freed her from her prison of stone. And what could the poor child do but agree to say everything the man told her to? So the boy she loved was dead. So the man lifted her up on his horse and took her home. Meanwhile, the hare ran to the stream, filled his mouth with live water, came back to where the boy lay, and spat the water into his eyes. The boy recovered his senses and awoke. He looked around, but there was no girl to be seen anywhere. to guess that something very terrible had happened and nearly wept with grief and misery. She wanted to run as fast as she could to the fire to tell him what had really happened, but of course it would have taken him a lot of time to get there on foot. And while he was wondering what to do, the wolf ran into the forest and found the boy's mare. He frightened it a bit, and it headed for the place where the boy was thinking what to do next. Once on horseback, everything seemed easier, and he set out to reach the palace. When he got there, he saw that everything was ready for the wedding and the merrymaking. He ran to the Tsar and told him the whole truth. However, the Tsar didn't believe him and went to ask his daughter. The young girl, naturally, only said what the man that brought her told her to say, that she saw the boy she loved being murdered. So the Tsar ordered the boy to be hanged for lying. Only then did they ask him who he was. "I'm the crippled hero," he said, "and I won't tell you anything more." So they took the crippled hero to be hanged. Meanwhile, the Tsar's daughter went into the garden to walk around a bit. The boy, who had been led to be hanged, suddenly saw his hair near the path. So he got half of the handkerchief the young girl had given him and threw it to the hare. The little beast picked it up and ran with it to the Tsar's daughter. She just looked at it and nearly fainted away. "What's ailing you?" asked the Tsar. She fell on her knees before him and told him all the truth, begging him not to kill the boy who had freed her from the serpent. So the Tsar gave the order not to hang the boy, but to bring him to their presence, to the palace. The boy came, carrying his bag with him, and told the Tsar the truth about all that had happened. The man who was going to marry the Tsar's daughter said that he was lying. When the boy heard this, he took the 12 tongues of the serpent out of his bag and said, "And what, may I ask you, are these?" The man could find no answer to his question, and meanwhile the girl showed her father the 2 halves of the handkerchief. Then, of course, everybody believed the boy. The great big fellow who tried to deceive everybody was hanged, while the crippled hero married the lovely daughter to try and get half the kingdom for a wedding gift. The wedding was wonderful. I was at the wedding and drank quite a lot, but didn't get drunk because I spilt most of the wine down my throat. You've been listening to a story from Belarusian Folktales, translated by L. Cortis and published by the Vistusia Skora Publishers in Minsk. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC, Atomic University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfarn. The executive producer is Carla Chimera. And I'm Ellen Fisher.
Hi, I'm Nilo Kokanen. Today, I'll be reading from the book Tales from the Finnish Supa by James Bauman and Marjorie Bianco, from a translation by Aili Kolehmainen. Mistä puhumme nyt? Minkä runot runoillen? Mikä laulun laulin minä? Rauta-ajan alusta, vakavanho Väinämöisen Kalevasta, ei, vaan annan kiere hölmälästä, pikku tyhmä hölmälästä. Years ago, a far-off corner of Finland, there was a little town called Hölmälä. The people who lived there were known as Hölmäläiset. It was very seldom that a stranger ever went to Hölmälä, and from living year after year by themselves, and never seeing or hearing anything of the outside world, the people who lived there grew to be quite different from the rest of the people in Finland, and rather queer in their ways. They were simple-minded and, above all, cautious. They liked to turn everything over very thoroughly in their minds before they came to any decision, and would make the most elaborate plans about even the smallest details of their daily life. When it came to any important question, they would talk about it for weeks and months and even years before they could make up their minds to act. So in time, the Hermilaiset grew to be quite a proverb among the other people in Finland, and a few strangers who visited them brought back some very funny stories about their ways. When the folk at Hermila first began to grow rye, they had the greatest difficulty in the world deciding how to harvest it. In fact, while they sat around talking and arguing about how the job should be done, their first crop ripened and tasted. There were only a few handfuls saved to feed the ground for the second year. By the time the second crop was ripe, the wise men of the village had thought out a very careful plan. Not a single grain was to be wasted this year. They divided the whole town into crews of 7 men each, and each crew set solemnly to work. The first man bent the rye stalk over one at a time. The second man held a piece of wood under each stalk. The third man cut the stalk with a sharp hatchet. The fourth man grabbed the stalk from the sheaves, which the fifth man bound. The sixth man carried the sheaves away, and the seventh broke them into a stack. And all this took so long that most of their crop was lost again, for by working their hardest, 7 men together could only harvest 2 sheaves a day. A stranger named Musty happened to visit the town while this great harvesting work was going on. He was so amused at this elaborate system that he decided to teach them something. So he hurried back to his town and returned with a sickle. That night, while the Hermelaer were resting after their enormous labors, Musty went by moonlight into the rye field. In a very short time, cut and bound more sheaves than all the town folk together had been able to harvest in a week. Then he dropped his sickle beside the last sheaf he had bound and went to bed. In the morning he came out to see what they would make of it all. When the Hermelaer men had found their rye all cut and bound, and sickle lying on the ground beside it, they were struck dumb with surprise. For a week and a day they did nothing but talk it over. At last they decided all this dangerous work must have been done by Noidakennoja, or magic spells. But the wizard who had done it had afterwards changed himself into the sickle. So now, for their own safety, they must get rid of the sickle, and the best way to do that would be to drown it. They all agreed, after much discussion, that anyone who touched the sickle or came within an eel's length of it would be taking a pipe into his hand. So they went to the woods and cut a long pole, and they tied a leather noose to the end of the pole, and with this they managed to drag the sickle along the ground. All the town folk came out to watch. Sure enough, that sickle was alive. Didn't it catch every inch of the way? Not to be drowned. It kept catching at roots and stumps and rocks at the banks of ditches, and it was with the greatest trouble in the world that at last the sickle was dragged to the edge of the lake. And then, well, then the five men left it there while they spent another day, standing around and arguing about how to get in the water. Finally, they dragged it into a lake and towed it out to the lake. With another pole and the noose, they managed to tie a big rock to the sickle so it wouldn't float. Then, with a shout, they tipped the rock into the water. But, not the sickle. The sickle caught onto the edge of their boat, and now they were all in a panic. That wizard was struggling to the very last gasp. There he hung, clutching at their boat, trying to drown them. Sure enough, the boat was tipping. The weight of the rock in the water was dragging it down. In another minute, they were all fluttering, paddling away for their lives. But the sickle was drowned. He was safe at the bottom of the lake, and the whole town declared a month's holiday to celebrate their escape. Now they could go on in their own ways, as their fathers had done, with no fear of wizards coming to interfere with them. When Musty next came to visit the Hermilaiset, he found them in a great to-do, one arguing with the other. They'd been arguing for over a year. And this is how it all began. As long as the oldest men of Hermila could remember, the Hermilaiset had always lived in kotas, or houses shaped like wigwams. I'd like to say the Finnish word for home is koti, which indicates that these wigwam-shaped houses were used in Aboriginal times. In fact, the word kot is a basic word among Indo-European people. Later, the Hermeneutic, after much thought, decided to copy the rest of the film, the Kings, and build for themselves a stupa. A stupa is a simple, one-room log hut. They had planned the work very carefully, divided the whole population into gangs. One man would cut down the trees, another was to trim the boughs, four others would peel the bark off, the seventh man would measure the tree in a length while the eighth and ninth cut up in the logs. Then the next four would carry these logs to the spot where the stupa was to be built. The 14th and 15th would match the logs to the ends as they fitted together, and the next four would set them in place for the walls. Later on, others would lay the roof. The work went slowly, but no great difficulty. Nothing went wrong until the first stupa was completed. Then a great shock awaited them. The wise men of the village had reasoned that the special advantage of the stupa was that it was always filled with sunshine, summer and winter alike. For they had argued that by building the walls and laying the roof while the sun was shining, and carefully chinking all the cracks as they went along, that sunshine would be trapped inside the stupa and kept prisoner there forever. But when their stupas were finished, instead of being filled with sunshine, it was black as pitch. And this so amazed the wise men that after all their calculations, they had to sit down and reason out just how it had happened. They were all sure that the sunlight couldn't possibly have escaped of its own accord. Hadn't they walled it in and roofed it down with all the care in the world? No, somebody had gone to work and let her out again, that was sure. The only person that could have done that was had been a wizard. So they set about getting the sunlight back in again by the use of charms and spells. But the charms didn't work. The spells didn't work. So they all sat down for their cottage again to think up another plan. After months of arguing back and forth, they prayed into agreement. What they had to do was to carry the sunlight into each stupa. A very simple idea. Why hadn't they thought of it earlier? Again, they organized the whole village. The women carded and spun and wove and made great woolen sacks. When they were finished, the men were divided into groups again. Eight men held each bag open to the sunlight. When the bag was filled with sunlight, the others quickly closed the sack and bound it tight to the horse sunlight in the face. Then the sack was carried inside of the stupa. But, no, that plan didn't seem to work either. They tried it over and over again, but something seemed to happen to the sunlight each time. So down they sat again to think it over, and the longer they argued, the more they disagreed. What happened to the sunlight, nobody could make out. When Mutsi arrived, he found them all shouting, quarreling 16 to the dozen. He listened to their careful arguments, their tales of woe, and said, "Men of Helmela, I don't pretend to be wiser than anyone else, but in our town we have long ago discovered the secret of the sun. If you'll pay me 1,000 marks, I'll show you how to get the sunlight into your stupa." After a long powwow, the villagers agreed. "Okay, then Mutsi, now watch." Into the nearest stupa he strode. He took his axe from his belt and hacked out a square hole in the wall. And in streamed the sunlight, flooding the earthen floor, the wooden bench, and the table with a golden glow. The villagers were amazed. In fact, they were so delighted with this great invention that they decided to improve it upon it themselves. They started to hack the whole wall, cutting more windows in it, shouting as they saw the sunshine pouring in more and more. They worked so hard at cutting more windows in the wall, at last the whole roof came tumbling down on their heads. And after this catastrophe, they decided, all things considered, a kota was a better kind of house for Hermeneutics than a stupa. You've been listening to a story from the book Tales from the Sea of Stupa by James Bauman and Marjorie Bianco, and the translation by Eile Kolehmainen. It's published by Albert Whitson and Company of Chicago in 1940. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Canella, and I'm Neil Kopenin.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Ellen Fitzgerald. Today, I'll be reading from the book Fairy Tales of the Sea, compiled by Elizabeth Cowan and Karen Davis. The Troll's Daughter. Once upon a time, there was a young man who went out into the world to seek his fortune, but he hadn't gone far when he met a rich and prosperous-looking man. "Whither are you, young fellow?" asked the man. "Are you bound up or down or over or under?" "I am out to seek my fortune wherever it takes me," replied the lad. "Well then," said the man, "you can seek it with me, for I knew just such a fellow as you, and I will pay you good wages, too. 1 bushel of money the first year, 2 bushels the second, and 3 the third. You must promise to stay the full 3 years, and you must do everything I ask, no matter how unpleasant you find it. For otherwise, I will have to discharge you, and you earn not a penny for all your pains." "I am not afraid of hard work, and little else would be painful," said the lad, and so the bargain was agreed to, and he went home with the man. But the strange place, not at all like your house or mine, sat inside a hill in the middle of a wild forest, and the man was strange too, for all he looked so rich and prosperous. In fact, he was not a man at all, but a great and powerful troll, and he had dreadful power over both men and animals. It was now too late for the lad to worry about the company he was in, however, and so he put it out of his mind and ate well and slept well, and then in the morning was ready for work. "You must first free all my animals," said the troll, "and though there's a whole forest full of them, and the barns are a mile long and a mile underground, still you must finish the task in 1 day. "I'll do what I can," said the lad, and he set to work at night. The barns were filled to the brim with deer and bears and wolves and hares, all enchanted by the troll, and hungry enough to eat the lad. But he waited night and morning, and by night the task was all finished. "Well," said the troll, "I don't see how you did it, but now that it's done, you deserve a good supper and a good night's rest. So take them and welcome to them." The lad ate well and slept well, and in the morning the troll said to him, "The animals are not to be fed today, for we did extra well by them yesterday, and there's no need to spoil them. Now you may play and do as you please till it's time to feed them again." "Oh, thank you," said the lad. "That will be fine indeed." But as he turned to leave, the troll caught him by the collar and cried, "Mumble, jumble, turn and tumble. Be a hare and do not fumble." And there, and then the boy was changed into a hare, and jumping away from the troll, he went leaping into the forest. But he had little fun in the forest, for he was the first and only animal seen there in a long, long time. And as soon as the hunters heard of him, they tried to catch him. They had no luck, however, for his legs were long and his eyes were sharp, and he managed to keep well out of their reach. In this way, a year and a day went by, and then the troll called him home again, "Mumble, jumble, turn and tumble. Be a boy and do not fumble," said the troll. And in a second, the lad had his own shape again. "Well," said the troll, "now that you're back safe and sound, how did you like the life of a hare?" "Oh, I like it well enough," said the boy. "I could run faster and leap farther than ever before." "But, of course, you've no wish to save me another year," said the troll. "Yeah, I have indeed," said the boy. "Life isn't all being stickles, whether you're man or mouse." "Very well," said the troll. "Now it's time to feed the animals again. And though they've not been fed for a year and are powerfully hungry, still you must finish the task in a day." "I'll do what I can," answered the lad. Then he went to the stable, which were now 2 miles underground and 2 miles long, and filled with might and main, feeding the deers and the bears and the wolves and the hares, and by night all the rest was gone. "Well," said the king, "I don't see how you did it. But as long as it's done, you deserve a good supper and a good night's rest. So take them and welcome to them." The boy ate well and slept well, and in the morning the troll said, "The animals are not to be fed today, for you did extra well by them yesterday, and there's no need to spoil them. Now you may play and do as you please till it's time to work again." Thank you, said the lad. That would be fine indeed. But before he could leave, the crow had him by the collar and cried, Mumble, rumble, tame and humble, be a bird and do not fumble. And then the boy became a raven, and away he flew into the air. Oh, this is so much better than being a hare, said the boy. I can fly fast and far, and I'll see a good bit of the world. But things were a little better, really, for no sooner did he throw himself on the edge of the forest than the hunters were after him with their guns and had to stay well hidden in the trees. The time went by, however, and when the rumor goes up, the crow called the lad home again. Mumble, jumble, tame and tumble. Be a boy and do not fumble, said the crow. And in a moment the boy was himself again. Well, said the crow, now that you're back safe and sound, how did you like the life of a raven? Quite nicely, thank you, said the lad. I could never have flown through the air if I'd been a mere boy. But of course you're not willing to stay another year, said the crow. Oh, yes, indeed I am, replied the lad. Money doesn't come easy, and I may as well earn it saving you as another. Very well, said Cole. Now you must feed the animals again, and though they've not been fed for a year and are powerfully hungry, still you must finish the task in a day. I'll do what I can, said the lad. Then he went to the barn, which were now 3 miles underground and 3 miles long, and he worked his night and moon, feeding the deer and the bears and the wolves and the hares, and by night all the work was done. Well, said the crow, I don't see how you did it, but as long as it's done, you deserve a good supper and a good night's rest. So take them and welcome to them. The lad ate well and slept well, and in the morning the crow said, not to feed the animals today, for they're still full from yesterday, and there's no need to stuff them. Now you may play and roam about at will. Oh, thank you, said the lad, that will be fine indeed. But before he could hang on, the crow caught him by the collar and cried, Mumble, jumble, turn and tumble, be a fish and do not tumble. And still and then the boy was changed into a heron, and giving a great leap, he jumped into a nearby stream. This would be a great sport, thought the boy. I'd swim all day from morning to night. But it was scarcely any sport at all, for he was the only fish that had been in the water for years. And at sight of him, the fishermen took out their lines and nets and tried to catch him. But they had no luck, for with his quick swims and his clever head, he managed to keep out of their reach. And presently he left the stream and swam down to the sea. He swam far out, and there he came to a beautiful glass castle that rested on the bottom of the sea. The rooms were made of white whalebone inlaid with gold and pearls. The stairs were hung with delicate seaweed, and in a courtyard grew tiny shell flowers and tall shell trees, and a little fountain flowed up from a small shell and fell down on little bells of coral, making lovely tinkling music that filled the whole castle and all the ocean around it. But the loveliest part of all was a young girl dressed in robes of rainbow silk and wearing a crown and long yellow hair. She went from room to room among the beautiful furnishings, her silken robe flowing behind her like sparkling water. And the boy had never seen anything so beautiful in all his days. The girl seemed lonely, however, for there was no one else in the castle. And as she walked about, she stopped often to gaze into one of the many mirrors that hung from ceiling to floor, or to look out through the castle's glass walls and into the ocean beyond. Yeah, did you see I'm round and round admiring her? Now then, the princess would like a little company, and if I were only a man instead of a fish, I could go in and pay her card. And perhaps I can think of her clothes well to make myself a boy again. And so hard, and in a moment the clothes words painted, mumble, jumble, time and tumble, be a boy and do not fumble, he cried, and in a trice he got his own shot. And went hurrying into the castle and straight up to the young princess, who gave her greeting. And this frightened her quite out of her wits, for she hadn't seen a soul in ever so long. But she soon recovered. And when the lad told her story, she was most happy to see him. They played together all day long, building little houses of shells and looking for pearls and making music on the coral bells. And in the evening, the princess cooked dumplings and tarts for the lad. And he slept on a bed of mast, and they slowed to sleep by the sound of the sea. In this way the time quickly passed, and then a year and a day that almost stopped, the princess said to the boy, "It's time for you to leave me. So turn back into a fish again and be ready to answer the crow's call." "But I didn't wish to leave you," said the lad. "Nor do I wish to leave you," said the princess, "but go you must. For my father, you see, is the crow whom you saved, and if he should catch you here, there would be trouble indeed. He has hidden me under the water so that no one can find me and take me away from him, and if he saw you here, he would chop off your head at once." "The crow is cruel and selfish," said the lad. "Yes, that is true," said the princess, "but don't be downcast, dear lad, for I think I'll find a way to trick my father and bring us together again." "Well, then let me hear it at once," said the lad. "Well," said the princess, "the king who lives next to my father is in debt to him, and if he cannot pay in a month and a day, he will lose his head when the time is up." "Oh, that's indeed sad," said the boy. "If you can help him, then let's help us too," said the princess. "Now, what can it be? Leave my father, taking with you the 6 bushels of money which are due you, and go straight to the next kingdom. There you must enter the service of the king, and when a month and a day are up, and the king is moaning and groaning and ready to lose his head, then you must tell him you know what is troubling him, and you must offer to lend him the money, on condition that you may go with him dressed as a fool and in cap and bells. This the king will be glad to allow, and when you're on your way, you must caper about with all kinds of nonsense and tomfoolery, and on reaching my father's palace, you must be ever so careless, rattling doors and breaking windows and furniture. This will anger my father in the end, and since the king must be responsible for any damage his fool does, my father will demand that the king answer 4 questions or lose his life. The 5th question will be, where dwells my fair daughter? But the king of course will have no answer, and then you must come forth and say, your daughter dwells far, far away on the bottom of the sea. That will be true. And then my father will ask, did you know my daughter if you saw her? And you must say, I know you in the dark with my eyes closed tight. Then my father will bring forth 1,001 maidens, and you will have to choose the one that arrives. But we will all look alike, and you can never choose the right one in 1,000,000 years. So I will have to help you a bit. I will touch you before I drop by. And then you can seize me and say, here's your daughter. This will take care of the 2nd question. The 3rd question will be, where has my heart been hidden? To this you must say, your heart is hidden in a fish. And then my father will ask, did you know that fish if you saw it? And you must answer, I would know that fish in the dark if I shut tight. At this, my father will command 1,001 fish to come forth, and you'll have to choose the one that holds his heart. But if they all look alike, you can never choose the right one in 1,000,000 years, so I have to help you. I'll give you a little stone, and you can touch it and cut it open. That will finish the crow, and then you'll be free to do as you please. You are a wonderfully clever princess, said the lad. Not more clever than you, said the princess, but hurry now and turn into a fish again. There's no time to lose. The lad did as he did, and in a flash he was home again and went swimming back into the sea. Soon after, the crow called him home again, saying, mumble, jumble, turn and tumble. Be a boy and do not fumble. Turn him into his own shape once more. Now that you're back safe and sound, how does it like being a fish? Oh, like the best of all, said the lad, the ocean is full of interesting things. Then of course you'll be glad to save me another year, said the crow. You'll earn 6 bushels of money and be worth 12. I do not care to stay longer, said the lad. I'll take my first 6 bushels and be on my way. To this the crow had to agree, for a bargain is a bargain, even with crows. The boy received his money, and with half of it tied in front and half of it tied behind, he started on his way. After a time, he came to the next kingdom, and when he'd safely hidden his money, he sought service with the king. Well, said the king, I need a lad to look after the stables, but truth to tell, it's not much I can tell you. Oh, it's only food and a bed I want, said the lad, and so the king gave him a place, and he worked hard in the stables, but an eye on the king, too, and saw as the days went by how sad and forlorn he looked. Then, when a month and a day were almost up, he went to the king and he said, "You need not grieve, good king, for I know what's troubling you, and I promise to help you." "But that's impossible," said the king. "I need 6 bushels of gold." "That's just the amount I have," said the boy. "Now, in return for lending you the money, you must let me dress as your court jester and run along before you. And you must let me get into any mischief I please and not worry about it. So I give you my word, I'll be sure to save us both." "Very well," replied the king. And the boy gave him the money, and when they made ready to go, the king wearing his best bib and tucker, and the boy dressed in cap and bells. After a goodly trip, they came to the crow's house, which now stood high above the ground, and it was splendid as a king's castle. It was made of the finest glass, and just the touch of a finger was enough to break it. At sight of it, the boy sped ahead as fast as he could, and bumped into windows and doors, and smashed everything at a merry rate. But the crow soon heard him and came rushing out and caught him by the heel. "What is the meaning of all this?" he cried to the king. "You can't pay your old debts, and yet you allow your fool to make new ones. Well, we'll soon have your head for such nonsense." "But I am quite able to pay my first debt," said the king, and he brought forth the 6 bushels of gold. The crow couldn't believe his eyes and measured the gold to the last ounce. It was all there, however, every penny's worth, and the crow couldn't find the least fault with it. But it was through the damage the fool had done. He had ruined the crow's beautiful castle, and that was something not even money could pay for. "It can only be repaid by answering 4 questions," said the crow, "and that, of course, you cannot do." "His Majesty will be very glad to try," said the lad, "and I'll do what I can, too." Then he placed himself beside the king, and the crow cried, "Where dwells my fair daughter?" "Your daughter dwells far, far away on the bottom of the sea," spoke up the boy. "Would you know her if you saw her?" then asked the crow. "Oh, indeed I would," said the boy. "I'd know her in the dark with my eyes closed tight. Bring her here at once." Then the crow raised his hand, and suddenly the room was filled with beautiful golden-haired maidens, and they passed one by one before the boy. But they all looked alike, and which was the princess he could not tell, till all at once one of them touched him. Then he knew he was the real princess, and they caught around the waist and cried, "Here's your daughter, Master Crow." The crow howled, and all the other maidens disappeared into thin air, and then the lad asked, "Well, now let's try the 3rd question." "You may try it, but you'll never guess it," cried the crow. "Where has my heart been hidden? That's the question." "That's easy," answered to the lad. "Your heart is hidden in a fish, Master Crow." "Would you know that fish if you saw it?" cried the crow. "Oh, indeed I would," said the lad. "I'd know it in the dark with my eyes shut tight. Bring it here at once." The crow raised his hand, and the room was full of swimming fish, but they all looked alike, alas. And which one had the crow's heart, the boy could not say. Then the princess seized his arm. Then he knew that the fish now swimming by was the one he wanted, and he reached out quickly and seized it. He cut it open, and at that moment the crow fell dead and burst into a million pieces of flint that scattered up and down the countryside and can be seen there to this day. Then the mountain split open, and all the birds and animals that had been enchanted came out and went to live in the forest once more. The lovely glass castle rose out of the sea and settled down on the edge of the forest, and the princess and the lad were married. All the kings from ever so many kingdoms came to see them, and the common people as well. They had a great feast, and then they found all the crow's money and spent it, and they lived happily ever after. You've been listening to a story from Fairy Tales of the Sea, compiled by Elizabeth Cowan and Karen Davis, and published by the Sea Grant College Program at Texas A&M University. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilson. The executive producer is Carla Canella. And I'm Ellen Fisher.